Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And this is my first podcast episode that I've recorded after returning from the awesome developer conference in Sweden, OrDev, where I actually spoke for the very first time. OrDev actually recorded the session, so if you want to check out my presentations on test automation trends for 2016 and beyond, and the test automation playbook, Succeeding with Automation Awesomeness, head on over to the show notes of this episode at testtalks.com/79. If you've never heard of the OrDev conference, you need to check them out. They had some awesome speakers like Todd Gardner, who gave one of my favorite presentations of the conference, Case Studies and Terrible Testing. After seeing his presentation, I had to get him on the show. So today, I'll be speaking with Todd Gardner all about terrible testing. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section. Hey, Todd, welcome to Test Talks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, Todd, before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. So I am a web developer and entrepreneur. About 3 years ago, I started a company called Track.js, which is a JavaScript error monitoring service. I speak at a lot of conferences, and I do a lot of JavaScript and web development.
Awesome. So I actually did see you at the OrDev conference in Sweden this year, and I really loved your presentation on terrible testing.
That's awesome. So, I love doing that talk. It's basically an excuse for me to get up on stage and rant about all the things I think are wrong.
No, it was awesome. And even your slides are really cool. So I'm going to have a link to that within the show notes. But I really enjoyed it. And that's why I want to just talk about some of the things that I thought about as I was watching that presentation. So I love how you started your presentation by asking the question. You said you always ask the question, am I testing the right thing? And that's actually, it seems like a simple question, but it seems like a question that a lot of people don't ask themselves. So why do you think that's important to ask before you start just creating tests for your application?
Are you from Boston?
Yes. Can you tell? I'm actually from Rhode Island, so it's a little worse than Boston.
It was just how you said started. That's awesome. So the question of, are you testing the right thing? I don't think is asked often enough because it's really hard. It's probably one of the hardest problems in software development to answer because the fundamental question inside of it is, what is the risk of this thing that we're doing? And that's a really contextual question about what your project is. Because there's all different kinds of risk that comes in with software development. Because this is a incredibly creative and complex activity that we're doing. But we're also working in an incredibly complex market or niche that you're operating in. And so there's all different things that can go wrong at so many levels. And so you have to think really critically about that. So for example, starting from the inside is, a lot of times when people talk about testing, developers immediately jump to the idea of a unit test. Well, so unit tests are really good for addressing certain kinds of risk. If you have complex logic inside of your application or just logic that is going to be changing frequently, unit tests are a good way to mitigate that risk. As we get out, like maybe it's how your system all comes together that is where the risk is. Maybe you're relying on lots of different microservices or you're reaching out to third parties. Well, writing integration tests to like exercise those connections can be a good way to mitigate that risk. But if we go out even further, ultimately there will be consumers of your app, which will either be other systems or people. And so writing system tests to, you know, simulate being those customers or those systems and run full transactions, that's a good way to mitigate that risk. But then there's a whole nother level of risk that is almost never talked about in development circles, and that's a market risk or a your customer risk of the thing that you're doing, the overall project. Does anybody care? Is this going to work? So one of the examples I give in my talk is about this giant project that I was a part of, where we spent 18 months at tremendous burn rates, tremendous numbers of developers working on this thing for a project that was an ultimate failure. And it was a failure because nobody purchased the product. It ended up being shelfware. And so how do you address those sort of risks by maybe building smaller, more focused pieces of software that, hey, maybe it's not as architecturally complete or it's not as quote unquote good as your final version would be, but can you consider the software itself a test for whether or not this project is going to succeed? And so I think that's a really hard question to ask when you start at the beginning of the project, is you have to sit back and everybody's super excited to move forward, but you have to think about how is this thing going to blow up in our face? And how can we try and reduce the risk of that happening, rather than just jumping into testing and development of the parts that we know? How do you start by testing the things that you don't know?
Awesome. Yeah, and that's what the main takeaway I took from your talk was risk. And I don't think a lot of people think of risk. They just do things just because it's supposedly a good practice or a best practice. And what I found interesting was that example you talked about. I think it was, you said they were burning $2 million a month for like 18 months or something.
Yeah.
And they never asked their users, this is something you want. So it's kind of scary how I think a lot of companies might actually operate that way.
Yeah, giant companies that you would expect to be more cautious than that. But you get into a situation, especially with large companies, where they feel that they understand, like, of course this is going to work. Like, you know, some person inside the company has bet their reputation on it and they're well respected. And they're like, yes, we're going to go do this thing. It's going to be awesome. The market's going to make us millions and millions of dollars and we're going to win. Just because your market forecasts tell you that this is going to happen. And even if a customer comes to you and says, yes, I think that's a great idea, I'm going to buy that. Until they actually, you know, give you those dollars, you don't know that succeeded until the users start using it. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of software. It's not always like, you know, like publicly commercial. Maybe you're building an internal app. But in that case, like until the user is actually using the product to create the value that you're trying to do, you don't know if this is going to work. So how do you build a piece of software that's as small as possible to generate some value and use that as a test for the larger project before you invest all of the time and effort and heartache in agonizing about an architecture and a testing structure internally? Maybe you could just write something quick and dirty. Maybe you could just pound out a quick Rails app or an ASP.NET app or whatever. Just get something small out for one customer and say, hey, we launched. Sign up. If they don't sign up, like, well, what does that tell you?
So it's almost like the whole lean startup concept where you do a quick iteration, get it out there, get feedback, and then build on that based on feedback.
Exactly. I was totally like going with the whole lean startup and MVP. I was trying to avoid the term MVP a little bit. Yep. Specifically in the talk, I don't even say it at all because I feel like that term is very overused. And I don't think a lot of people really understand what it means. Is minimum in a lot of contexts might be a lot. Minimum doesn't necessarily mean half-assed, and it doesn't mean always small. It's thinking critically about your product and saying, what is the smallest thing we could do to deliver value? And I think either people will deliver too little or they'll dismiss it and say, of course, we have to deliver the whole project in order to deliver value. That's what we've, you know, built the financial case for this thing on. But I think you have to spend a lot of time critically thinking about what subset can you deliver to some subset of user to see if you're right.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I work for a large enterprise company that writes medical applications. So we have test sites at hospitals where we have actually users that try the application as we're developing it. So like you said, it's not a half-assed solution. We're trying to do a real solution. It has to be because it's FDA regulated, but also we're trying to get that quicker feedback. So it's a great point you bring up.
Yeah. So for that kind of thing where you do have a lot of regulations, you can't cut corners with healthcare and that sort of thing, but maybe you could build a solution that works for one kind of workflow, one kind of procedure for one hospital.
Yep.
And say, okay, we built it for that hospital. Does it work? Will they buy it? Will they give us some cash in exchange for this to prove that this is a thing? And then we'll figure out how to scale it up to 10,000 hospitals. Because you don't need to worry about the architecture to scale up to 10,000 until you know you actually have a market for 10,000.
Yep, so true. So I think what you also talked about is this, the testing pyramid, and how you think it's not actually a great example of how to think about testing per se, because it's missing the main point that you talked about is it's missing user tests. So can you just explain a little what you mean by, I think you renamed it testing scales, and I really like that concept.
Yeah. So when I was first starting, and what a lot of people first read about when we start talking about software testing is this concept called the software pyramid, where you have a lot of unit tests at the bottom of a pyramid. So your system should have a lot of unit tests because unit tests are cheap, a few integration tests because they're a little bit more expensive, but they test a different part of your system, and a few system tests. And they design this thing in this funny little diagram that looks like a pyramid that I imagine you could link up in your show notes so that people can see that. I think that that is a flawed model for two reasons. The first is that it misses that this whole thing that we've been talking about, market risk, about whether or not the project itself is a good idea and how do you test that, which is really operating at a level above system tests. The second problem that I have with the model is that it's implying volume. It's saying you should have more unit tests than integration tests because unit tests are cheap to write. And I think that that's missing the point. Is it's not how cheap or expensive it is to write and maintain. It's what kind of risks are being addressed by those sort of tests. A lot of web applications that I tend to write today are really trivial. You know, I'm just trying to demonstrate a concept, or I'm just trying to, you know, build a CRUD app for some purpose. And I call it, you know, I'm basically converting SQL into HTML and back. And in those sort of apps, there's very little functional complexity happening. Usually I have a framework I've shoved in place that's handling, abstracting all of that stuff away. And so I don't really see a lot of risk in my functional logic at that level. And so I tend to not write a lot of unit tests in that situation because I don't see what it's getting me. Like, if it works, it's going to work. And if it doesn't work, it's not going to work. At that level, I don't have a whole lot of complexity there. But where I do have some complexity is typically in an integration level where, hey, can my app talk to my database and am I writing queries correctly? So write some integration tests around that. And am I presenting a user interface that makes sense? And so I'll write some system tests around that. And so depending on the app, I might have completely inverted the pyramid. I might have 10 system tests, 5 integration tests, and 1 unit test for the one actual interesting piece of logic I have in an app. And that totally messes with that metaphor of a pyramid. And so that's why I think it's a scale instead. And this is one of the things I talk about a lot in the talk, is I think rather than prescribing how many of one kind of tests you should have over another, you should look at, say, what kind of risks exist in my system? How can my system break? And build the testing coverage that you need in each of those areas to address the risks of the system.
That was the beauty of your presentation. You actually worked on projects where they had technically 100% code coverage and they still failed. So how can that be true? How can you have 100% code coverage and a test still fail?
So I have worked on a couple of different projects where a certain level of code coverage was enforced. And when you put a metric in place saying, hey, we will have 80% code coverage or we will have 100% code coverage, you're not actually saying anything about like how much quality you want in your code base. Mm-hmm. Simply, how many lines of code must be executed as a result of running tests. And so that comes down to, or it puts a force on the culture of your team. If you have a team who doesn't really believe in the testing, the same things that the management who put this requirement on you says, then you're just going to get a bunch of shortcuts. In one particular example, I was part of a project that would do what I'd call assertion-free testing, where we would loop over the objects and just call every function and bury the exceptions that come out of them. And we'd hit 100% code coverage. It was super easy to hit 100% code coverage. It just, it didn't test anything. Like, the app was a total disaster. On a more recent project, we actually had 100% code coverage mandate, which it's really hard to get those last few percentage points. You end up testing a bunch of really stupid code that's like, of course this is going to work. I'm testing a property getter. Like, why would this ever fail? This is stupid. But you'd have to do it in order to hit that arbitrary metric. And so if you think about all of the different numbers, like if you come onto a project and you ask, hey, what's the code coverage number that we're working for? There's only two numbers that they can respond that tell you anything at all about the organization. And if they tell you, well, zero, we have 0% code coverage. Well, that tells you one thing. It tells you that they're not testing. It doesn't necessarily tell you anything about their quality. It just tells you that, like, hey, there's some risk here. Maybe it's high, maybe it's low, that they haven't addressed it. So we should talk about that more. On the opposite end of the spectrum, if they tell you we have 100% code coverage, all that really tells you is that they have an organization that has incentivized that metric. It doesn't actually, again, tell you anything about the quality of the code base, because they could be just hacking in tests. They could be developing giant mock objects that just totally subvert any real logic in the application. They could be doing all sorts of bad practices of their tests that could not tell you anything about the software itself. And any other number in between tells you nothing at all for all of these same reasons. Is the test, our code coverage, is just a reflection of how big the tests are, not how good the tests are or what risks are being addressed. And I don't feel like there's any quantifiable metric to do that. Testing ultimately comes down to the commitment from the team, whether they think it's valuable or not, and what they're trying to address with those tests.
It's a great point. I don't know what I feel worse about, 0% code coverage or 100% code coverage, because I've worked with teams that show me a dashboard and go, look, we have 98% code coverage. And I know it's those tests are useless, most of them. So it's almost like they give themselves false confidence without actually thinking, are we actually testing the right things, the risky things, like you said? And that's probably something I think is a mind shift that a lot of people need to go through.
Right, because those tests aren't free. Like, when you say, I want to add a test to the system for X, what you're trying to do is you're trying to address the risk of something breaking. But you've also introduced cost and complexity. Is now anytime I want to change that part of the system, I have the test to be confident, but I also have to keep this test up to date. And if what I found is that when you get into teams that have really high, like arbitrary high levels of code coverage, you've just created a ton of busy work. You've created a ton of resistance to making further productivity, because the tests, when you get up that high, they probably aren't giving you that much more material confidence in your system, but they are creating a lot of resistance to making change. You make a what you feel is a trivial change to a code base, and six tests break because you violated their mock expectations now. And that's just so frustrating to work in those sort of environments.
Awesome. So another thing you brought up, and I didn't look it up yet, was test-induced design damage. In a nutshell, what is test-design damage? Is this due to over-testing or using too many mocks for something that's really not testing the real application?
Yeah, so this was a conversation that came from DHH. For those not familiar, DHH is one of the co-founders of a company called 37 Signals and the creator of Rails, the popular web application framework. And so in 2014, I believe, at RailsConf, he gave a keynote and a blog post that came out at the same time called Test-Induced Design Damage. And so it was a little provocative. It got a bunch of people kind of worked up. It didn't fully address the topic, but what the point he was trying to make is largely that he doesn't feel that it is necessary to change his code to accommodate the tests. When he can't test something because of how it's written, he's not willing to change it and just to write a test for it, because if it muddles the design of the code that he thinks it should be put in. And so the point he was trying to make is that people who advocate for TDD and heavy unit testing structures are damaging their internal code to make it fit within that mindset. Now, there was tons of back and forth and a large online debate that happened during this time. But what came out of it was this video series that ThoughtWorks put together. It's all out on YouTube. I think there's like 3 or 4 half-hour parts. And it's DHH, Martin Fowler, who's from ThoughtWorks and, you know, written tons of high-level books, and Kent Beck, who's the, you know, originator of XP and test-driven development, a proponent of all those ideas. The three of them got on a video call together and debated this concept. And I think those debates are fantastic. They illustrate Kent Beck's motivations behind it, how he's shooting for, you know, confidence, and he's trying to address the fear of changing his systems. Martin Fowler brings up the idea of classical testing or classical TDD versus mockish TDD, and the pros and cons of using mock objects. And I think DHH has a really powerful concept that it doesn't matter, like, what your code looks like and what your testing structure looks like. These are just interim things. What matters is the software we ship, the value that's created at the end of the day. And I think the perspective of his that I really liked was that ultimately he shipped Rails and he shipped Basecamp and he shipped a ton of really valuable products that you can't argue that these are bad pieces of software because they don't follow TDD and they don't have these testable architectural patterns in them. They're valuable because literally millions and millions of people use these pieces of software every day. And so I think there's some power to his argument there that, hey, maybe these things don't matter quite so much as we think they do.
Cool. And I don't think you're saying, maybe I'm wrong, I didn't get away thinking you're saying testing is stupid. Don't test. It's just test the right thing. You want it to test smart, not just test for the sake of testing, I would think.
Right. And I don't think, I'm definitely not saying that. And I don't think DHH was saying that either, because there's definitely cases where, hey, here's, you know, you have some scary piece of logic somewhere in your code that, you know, tends to break and tends to be a source of bugs. You should absolutely have, you know, tests around that to make sure that you understand how it works and you are confident to make changes in how it works. The problem that I think DHH was bringing up, and I'm certainly bringing up, is that applying the ideas blanketly across your app that we have to TDD everything and we have to have unit tests on everything is a waste of time, because there's certain parts of your app that are trivial to understand and are not going to break. They're parts that your system that is well understood, and you heavily rely on the underlying frameworks or languages or runtimes that you're operating in, and just don't need the test coverage. But I think that's up to each team and each application to figure out and make the decisions on those bits. So what are the parts of your code that are risky, that concern you, that tend to break? And have good tests around that actually address those risks and give you the confidence. And if the part doesn't scare you, if anybody on your team can look at a piece of code and be like, duh, of course that's what it does, and it doesn't break, and if this is just works, then why are you wasting your time writing tests for that? Move on to the next thing.
I think a lot of people have heard about shift left, but I've been hearing more about shifting right, where, and I think this kind of goes into one of your points, maybe I'm wrong, but that a lot of architectures like microservices, you don't necessarily know how your user is going to interact with your services, how they're going to use them per se. And the only way really to get that is to actually almost test in production or monitor in production. And I've been hearing more and more about like predictive analysis, where you actually monitor in production and you're able to roll back based on predictive analysis, like saying you think these users are going to start having issues, but before they know there's an issue, you've been monitoring it, so you roll it back. So it's almost like performance testing. You never can really performance test correct unless you're in the production environment. So some of these things you can't really test anyway. so that maybe we need to invest a little bit more in our after production. After we release the code, it's not over. We need now to then also start including some sort of monitoring solutions for these things. Do you agree with that, or is that something you've been seeing more and more of?
I absolutely agree with that. So I can't remember where I heard this quote, and I'd love to attribute it to somebody, but I'm just going to repeat it anyway and say that it wasn't me, but it's really clever. It's that if you have any sufficiently advanced automated testing system is indistinguishable from monitoring. Because if you get to a really advanced set of tests where you are exercising real code paths on real systems and you can predict when things are going to fail, well, that's kind of the same thing as just testing it all the time in production, which is monitoring. And I think that's really, I think in a lot of ways, it's better than testing. Testing can tell, you can write tests for the parts of the system that you think are going to fail, that you can conceive, hey, I think this can break. I'm going to write some tests around it. And the time to write the test and maintain the test and run the test fits within our idea of the budgets and the time constraints of the system. But you can never test everything. It doesn't make financial sense to test everything. There's always some parts of your system that you can't adequately test for, nor should you, because it's just not financially worth it. And that's where monitoring comes in. So when you put your system out into production, you should put proper monitors around what's the user doing, what's the system doing, how is it acting, so that when a user runs into trouble, you can react to it very quickly. So when you put your system into production, and the user starts interacting with it, it can fail in all kinds of ways that you can't predict. Yep. So monitoring your application at all the different levels lets you get a better understanding of how your system really breaks. And if you've built your system in such a way that you can react to those, if you emphasize monitoring as a important part of your system up front, you can react to those monitoring things and either roll back your system if it's a result of a current change, or quickly patch a bug and put it out. So as a real life use case of that, with my own system that I build alongside with my team at Truck.js, we don't test everything. We test the parts that we think that can break, but there's always parts that we miss. But we heavily monitor our own system. And so when a customer runs into problem, we treat that as such a high priority that when an exception happens to our system, we don't just dump that into a log somewhere. We dump it into our active chat channel that the entire team sits in. It's like, a customer just ran into this problem. Pipe this exception into the system or into our main log, which can sometimes be noisy. However, we try to address and smash down those issues as fast as we can. So we find out a customer had a problem. We dig into the issue. If it's a false positive, we add the appropriate rules to not throw those kinds of exceptions and push out that change. If it is a real issue, we reach out to that customer typically within an hour, apologize that this issue happened, explain what's going to go on, and we can typically get out a patch for that problem within 6 hours. Built, tested, and released to production. Because we've emphasized those parts of our system, we're able to do those fast turnarounds. And because our target audience are developers, they tend to respect that fast turnaround. And we get tremendous customer loyalty from the people who have experienced bugs in our system because we gave them that high level of service. As we responded right away, we apologized right away, and we fixed and we showed out how fast and responsive we are as a company. And so they really appreciated that. And so in a way, building a system that is fast to repair is almost better than having a system that doesn't break.
That's a good point. And you actually practice what you preach. You have a real application that you're actually doing this on. So I think you have some really good experience with it, and it sounds like it's working for you. I don't know if it'll work for everyone, but it sounds like, like you said, it depends on risk and how much risk you're willing to take with your applications, depending on what they're doing.
Absolutely. Like for your case, you're working in healthcare. You have a whole different risk profile than what I'm doing. So like you can't necessarily have the same level of open risk when you go to production that I feel comfortable with.
Yep.
The risk of, we have different parts of our system and each part of our system has different levels of risk. But like for our UI, I'm comfortable with a little bit more risk in that, because the worst case scenario is somebody might have a, you know, a clunky experience in the UI. We record the error and we can patch it really fast, but no data is lost. Nobody is harmed. And so we're comfortable with a higher level of risk there. We have a different part of our app that our customers actually include in their applications. And I'm not as comfortable with a high level of risk there. And we have a far more robust testing structure in that part of our application. And then for a healthcare app, if you are, say, building a healthcare device, I want you to have a very low tolerance for risk. Right, yeah. I don't want you shipping a version of a pacemaker that has, you know, a high level of risk in it. I want you to be really sure that that works. And so the overarching point of my talk and my message is that it depends. Is I'm not saying, hey, Todd said you don't need to test and go ahead and push it to production. It's fine. That's totally not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that you need to think critically about your application and your tolerance for risk and build a testing structure and a monitoring structure that accommodates what you're willing to do as cheaply as possible.
Awesome. So I know we mentioned TrackJS a few times. What is TrackJS?
So TrackJS fits firmly into that monitoring phase of testing. What TrackJS is it's a JavaScript error monitoring service. And so say you're building a web application using, you know, any of the hot frameworks right now, Angular, Ember, React, Ember, or just native, whatever. When you build that application, it's a little different than building a server-side application because you're taking code and you're shipping it out to your client. Your client is a web browser and your application is running in their web browser. And there's tons of different web browsers that all have their different quirks. And the users themselves can inject all kinds of, you know, toolbars and extensions into them that can change how your app runs. And so it's really no surprise that JavaScript applications tend to break a lot in ways that the developers don't always predict. And so this is what TrackJS is trying to solve, is we can give you a script that you can include with your JavaScript app, and we'll track what are the things that are happening in that application and give you reports when your users are running into problems. So JavaScript errors themselves aren't always particularly valuable. The stack traces tend to be kind of terse and uninformative. The big thing that we think is different about our service is the telemetry timeline. So we track a bunch of things that are going on in the application before the error happens. So we know the messages that are being logged in the console. So how your application state changes. I know what AJAX events are happening. How is the client communicating with the server? And I know what the end user is doing. So I know what are they clicking on? What input fields are they interacting with? So that when an exception happens that we need to report, I give you a bunch of information about that error, but I also tell you how did the user get to this error. They get to this error because an IE9 user who clicked on this page and entered an email address in this input and clicked on this button caused this error. And so we feel like our error reports give a tremendous amount of information back to the web developers or operations teams to know how is the web application failing in the hands of real users so you can respond to them and fix those problems fast.
Awesome. Sounds really cool. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm definitely going to try it out, check it out. It's like a really great piece of technology to especially help you, like you said, to catch those things that you probably couldn't even test if you tried. It's something that's actually, you're augmenting almost your coverage using this type of tool.
Right. Testing JavaScript, although it's been getting more popular in recent years, is still kind of hard to test every use case. Testing promises is always clunky. Testing asynchronous events is always a challenge. And so there'll inevitably be a time in your web application where that value trade-off hits. And you're like, you know what? It's not worth spending any more time testing this. We need to ship this thing. We think it's going to work in most cases. And so you add TrackJS to understand what cases happen in real life that we didn't test for. How is our application really breaking? Or understanding that the web isn't a static platform. And just because you tested every path in your application now, Chrome is going to come out with an update in 6 weeks, and Microsoft Edge is going to come out with an update in a couple of weeks. And is your app still going to work in that new version of Chrome? Is it still going to work in Microsoft Edge? Is it still going to work when Safari 10 launches? The web isn't standing still, and so we need to make sure that our apps continue to work as the web moves forward.
Awesome. Okay, Todd, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their JavaScript testing efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you or learn more about Track.js.
The best advice I can give around testing JavaScript applications is to separate your code into the parts that are orchestrating events from the parts that are actually doing real logic. When you convolute the event callbacks and interactions with the DOM with the actual logic that is manipulating data structures and communicating with the server, you get into these nasty callback messes that have become really hard to test and really hard to write targeted tests around the parts that can actually break. So thinking about the architecture of your front-end code to put together pieces that are easy to test the parts that can break, and don't worry about testing the parts that won't break. And then, of course, adding Track.js in for all the times that you were wrong. So you should check out Track.js. We offer a free 30-day trial so you can put it in your app and see if it works for you. You can find that at trackjs.com. You can contact me. I'm Todd at trackjs.com. Feel free to email me with questions or calls of heresy or telling me I'm terrible and I'm wrong and I should be TDDing everything. Or you can argue with me on Twitter. I'm at Todd H. Gardner.
Thank you, Todd, for your JavaScript testing awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/79. And while you're there, click on the Sign Up Now link under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And if you had a few seconds, I would love it if you clicked on the subscribe in iTunes link or the RSS feed or Stitcher and go ahead and leave a review and hopefully a 5-star ratings within iTunes. They really do help in the rankings of the show, and I appreciate all the feedback I get. Like the two reviews I just received from Stairpike from Australia and from Ging Girl from the US. Thank you for your awesome reviews and feedback. And if this episode has helped you in any way or you think it could help someone you know, why not share it with a coworker or a friend, and together we can help spread automation awesomeness to the masses. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with test automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.